afternoon. So last time, we talked first about file descriptors. We mentioned this idea that these are pointers to a file that in a Unix-like operating system, each process has an array of these pointers, that the pointers are copied on fork. So if we have our index 0 pointing to the terminal, after fork, we'll have two processes that point to the same file in that index of their file descriptor array. The close operation just sets one of these pointers to null. So if we close index 0 in one process, it just makes this pointer not point there anymore. But if we have pointers to, say, the terminal from elsewhere, they'll still work. And we have this dupe2 operation, which makes y point to the same file as x. Conceptually, it assigns files of y get set to files of x, so they both point to the same place. We talked about the read and write system calls, and they both have this format that they take a system call, a file descriptor that index into the array, a buffer, so some place to put bytes, and a number of bytes. And they both read or write up to the amount requested in this number of bytes. So it's up to, so you don't always get the full amount. And the general policy is that read is going to wait for some number of bytes to be available, like at least more than 0, if that's possible, and then return whatever it has. And write, by default, just tries to write everything, but sometimes something might break, in which case it will tell you, oh, I wrote, the first 100 bytes, but, then the network broke. So it'll just tell you, here, the first 100 bytes were written. And they return the amount that were read or written, or on failure, a -1, where failure means nothing was read or written. And this -1 is different than what re-returns for end of file. So end of file is not a failure, so re-return 0 for that, saying, hey, you asked me to read stuff, there's nothing more to read. Which is different than you asked me to read stuff, but the disk broke. That would be a failure. Then we talked about pipes and pipelines. So we mentioned that one feature that shells support is running POSIX calls a pipeline, where we run one command and send its output to another command. And we can implement this with the pipe library function, which gives us a pair of connected file descriptors such that we can write to one file descriptor and it goes into some buffer in the OS and comes out for the other file descriptor. And this allows process A to write somewhere that process B will eventually read. And this allows us to achieve this effect. And to make them actually share the file descriptors, we can take advantage of the fact we can create this pair of file descriptors and then spawn A and B after forking, so they share pointers to the same pipe. Questions about things we covered last time? Okay, not seeing any. So, a brief note on the quiz. I didn't include some information I should have in the switch questions, which made them a lot less clear. My sort of intention was that you would be working from, all the switches that are relevant to this question are shown in the code above, but that wasn't something I actually wrote down. Also, I wrote struct context instead of struct context star, which was just a mistake. On probably the question which seemed to cause the most confusion, which I'm going to mention primarily because some people didn't realize what was going on, we had sort of foo, which had this switch, and we asked basically if bar is running now, where are foo's registers saved? We didn't ask this exact question. We actually asked about an argument to Foo, but typically this argument would be in a register, might also be on FooStack. And sort of there are two possibilities here, and the one I intended, because my intention was all the switches were shown, is that if the registers were saved from this switch call, it would be on FooStack, because part of either calling switch or switch's code would save those registers before actually going to whatever thread would end up running bar. If the registers were saved because some sort of exception interrupted this ellipses code here, then we'd expect them to be saved in a trap frame, but the trap frame's allocated on the kernel stack, and if foo is running using its kernel stack, it would happen to be the same stack. So those were our two possibilities. And I think some people were confused and didn't realize that in this case, where if they're saved by calling switch, they're just saved on the stack right away. There's no trap frame involved, because presumably this is called after we already had an exception occur earlier, and there's the trap frames for some older code that was running before foo was started. Any questions about this? Okay, not seeing any. So let's keep going. So, can I go over question one on the quiz? Let me actually pull up the quiz. So, question one was asking, saying that if first had been set by this call to switch, so this means that first to save the registers as of just after this dot 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 runs, and the counter is zero, and then bar is called. Well, the first thing bar is going to do is switch back to the saved registers, which means it's going to end up returning to here. So that increments the counter by two and prints out foo one. So we have foo1 with the counter of 2, so we have one of these last five options, one of these four options here. And then it switches back to this return from this switch call because it's switching 2 second, which was just saved. Counter gets incremented by 1, and bar gets printed out, then bar returns. It's true that foo hasn't returned yet, but that's not going to stop bar from returning. Presumably sometime later, we'll end up switching to the rest of foo. And then another question. In question four, why is this last option possible? So what would have happened here in this scenario is that We started in PID 10, we called fork to make a child process, and that child process had PID 20, but at this point, we're still, because we got that PID, we're still in PID 10. Then we called fork again, and we got 0, which means we must be in the child process, and for this to be 40, apparently that second child process's PID is 40. I should mention here that we haven't said anything about how process IDs are assigned, but operating systems, don't necessarily, and often in practice, do not assign them sequentially, and which ones are assigned will depend on what else is running on the system, which we have no information about here. And then there's a question, why is this first option not possible? So because these two fork calls returned a child process ID, we must have been on the parent side of both of them. And if that's the case, we should have the same process ID here and here. And in this call, we do not. And then a question about question two here. So question two, if first has been set, is the same scenario as question one, but we're asking, after bar returns, where will the value of first have been set? Well, that's the last call to switch that ran that set first, which is this one. This call, so, and which is also happens to be the last call to switch that ran in this case. Okay. Any other questions about the quiz? Or follow-ups? Not seeing any, so I'll get to our main topic for today, which is we're going to talk about scheduling. We're going to look at how XV6 schedules processes. So we've looked at sort of the low-level mechanisms for doing context switching, but we haven't sort of talked about the higher-level idea of, like, how do we decide what program to run? And how do we actually, you know, trigger the code that switches to a particular program? So one thing we need to think about is, well, how do we store the list of running programs? In XV6, they're stored in this array. So this is a global array. It happens to be in a global struct. So this is ptable.proc. It's that global array. It has a fixed maximum number of processes. XV6 decided, let's keep things simple and not, like, try to dynamically allocate this. At the cost of, well, if you want to run more than nproc, whatever that constant is, processes, you can't. There's also this lock here. This is to keep more than one thing from accessing it at a time. So XV6 supports multiple cores. So if we have one core starting a process and another core is looking for a process to switch to, we don't want that other core to get confused by this half-started process. Also, we don't want it to be the case that while we're, like, starting a process, an exception will happen, and during handling that exception, we'll end up looking at a half-started process. So this lock is to keep both of those scenarios from happening, that while we're manipulating a process, and it might be in sort of a half-ready state, we don't look at it from elsewhere, from an exception handler or from another core. So we have this list of processes, and we were recently talking about fork, and one of the things XV6's fork needs to do is it needs to allocate an entry in this table. And the algorithm for doing that is we just scan through the table. This is using a pointer rather than, like, an array index. So it sets it to point to the first element, and until it ends up pointing past the end, we just XV6 scans through this, looking for something where the state is unused. So some code that I didn't show you initializes all the states to unused. And when it finds one, it jumps to this found part of this function that we'll talk about what actually happens then later. And if it doesn't work, there's some code here which returns an error from fork saying you're out of memory, or out of processes. So this question about this comparison here. So this is a comparison to a pointer. So basically, we have our ptable.proc proc is an array. And this here is a pointer to here. And this here is the same thing as ptable.proc of 0, taking a pointer to that. So it's a pointer to here, which when we do this plus plus operation gets advanced down the array, and we're waiting for it to get to the end of the array. And I probably should draw this more carefully. This is actually a pointer. This nproc thing is a pointer just past the end of the array. So there's a question, how many processes do we get? You can look up the value of nproc. I don't have it memorized. It's defined in one of the header files in XV6, and you could change it. Question also that I told you that this P++ goes to the next element in the array. Why, and there's a question, why isn't this written as P+ equals 4? So in C and C++, if you do pointer plus equals x, this turns into assembly that adds x times the size of the pointer, or the thing the pointer points to the pointer. And that's just a rule about how pointers work in C and C++, precisely to make code like this more convenient. Other questions? Okay, so gone over allocating a new process, which is something we do from fork. Now, there's a little bit of a tricky case we need to deal with. This is, what about the first process? So, like, if this is done when we call fork, something has to be available to call fork the first time. So, there's a special case for creating the first process. And it uses the same logic we use on fork for allocating a process, which is encoded in this alloc proc function in XV6. But the first process is special because, you know, we have to run it somehow. So we allocate a struct proc. It's set to the special value init proc just for convenience. And there's this init UVM function, which is basically a just copy something into the memory of this process. So this loads the program's memory. We'll talk much later in the semester about how XV6 manages a program's memory, but what this function does with that logic is it loads from this global constant this many bytes into the memory of the program. And then XV6 manually configures a trap frame for the program, because remember, the way that sort of our context switching works is that we pretend we're in the middle of an exception and we return from that exception. So we're setting up the save registers for the exception that we're going to pretend happened, that we're going to return from. And for this initial code, they hard code the stack pointer and the address of the first instruction to run. So there's a question about this init UVM. Why does this binary init code start? This is a pointer to machine code. And the machine code comes from a file initcode.s. It's not literally in that file, but it's produced from the assembly in that file. And the size is the number of bytes of machine code, is the size of that machine code, probably as a long. I'm not sure the cast is actually necessary. I guess it's probably unsigned, which is probably why there's a cast. Other questions? Someone's cleaning this. Someone's mentioning that. Oh, right. So the init code size is defined as a char array, but it's cast to an int. Yes, I'm not sure why they did that. But it probably has to do with how the linker sets this up. That they needed to do that to make it work. And I missed that. I had the declaration of it on this slide. Okay, so this is, but anyways, we copy this into the program's memory, we set up the initial registers, and we mark the process as runnable. So there's some other code, which is what we're going to spend most of our time talking about, which is going to find, oh, there's something runnable, I'm going to run it. And when this gets run, this does the initial program, and what the initial program is that it basically just does execv init, where init is a program on the file system that's the actual first program we want to run that's more interesting. But they needed some code to start that, and the way they did this is they just hard-coded a short program that would do that. Now, we're going to talk about the process of actually running processes, and to do that, we're going to talk about threads. And this is because our textbooks, and we're going to talk about thread scheduling, even though it looks like for now we're running processes, and for terminology, a thread is the part of a process, a thing that runs on a CPU, so it has our saved register values, our saved program counter, and so on, sort of represents what state would be stored in the processor, but it's separate from, say, memory, open files, current working directory, and other information like that, process ID, so on. So in XV6, we have this process control block that's our information about a process. And I would say that what I've highlighted here are the information about a thread. So we have our kernel stack, we have our state. We'll talk about what the possible values of this are later. But this, and we have our saved registers from an exception or from a switch inside the kernel, and also information about what event we're waiting for, if we're waiting for, like, input on a keyboard or similar. Now, XV6 only has one thread per process, so these are just part of the process's state, but quite commonly, operating systems will support multi-threaded processes, in which case we'd have multiple copies of these registers and the program counters and multiple stacks, and so on. This is just not what XV6 supports, and since it doesn't, it just puts all of this stuff in one struct, rather than like having a struct with a pointers to another struct for the thread specific information, which we'd expect from a multi-threaded process. So notably in this multi-threaded process, we end up sharing our files, we end up sharing our stuff in memory, except the stacks are conceptually not shared. Usually one thread, when it's running, can access the other thread's stacks, but they each one has a stack that it's using for its stack pointer that is independent of all the other threads. So the question is, how does this relate to the concept of core? So each of these threads is a thing which could be run on a core because at some point in time. So if we have a multi-threaded process, we could run each of these threads on a separate core if we had enough cores, or we could use one core and just take turns with that core. It's up to the OS what they end up doing. there's a question. In this multi-threaded process model, they all, these threads have the same PID? Yes. So if we wanted to identify a particular thread, we need some other sort of ID. So there's a question, how does XV6 support multiple cores but only single-threaded processes? So in XV6, if you want to take advantage of multiple cores, you need to run multiple processes. The question of, I mentioned that, you know, we could have multiple threads even if all the threads are sharing one core. So why would we bother with that? Well, it might be a more convenient way of programming. We'll talk about multi-threaded programming a lot later in the semester. And some would argue that for it's more convenient to be able to write code that uses multiple threads, even if you aren't getting the advantage of using multiple cores as a result. And there's a question, what does the ellipses stand for at the bottom? Anything I didn't think about, which is part of the thread state, I didn't actually mention anything. Okay. So we have these threads, and these threads are the things we're going to actually run on cores. And we're going to look at what running these threads looks like, and when we're tracking threads, we're going to have the threads in various states, and XV6 tracks this information explicitly, and I've given the names of the XV6 constants for each of these states. So we start our threads in as some new thing, so there's some mode where they're being created. XV6 uses the term embryo to mark these things, that they're setting up a process. And then they become what I'll call ready or runnable. So XV6's constant is runnable for this. And these are things which could be put on a core, but currently are inactive. So they've been switched, context switched away from, or never context switched to. And these, at some point, the OS might decide to run them. And then one of two things will happen. Either this will run up until some point where it doesn't have any more work to do, and it's going to be waiting for something. So what things might it be waiting for? Might be waiting for keyboard input, might be waiting for some amount of time to pass, you know, some sort of event external to the thread to happen before it's able to be run again. So even if the OS, you know, has nothing better to do, if some thread is in this waiting state, or what XV6 calls sleeping, it can't run it. It just has to leave that core idle instead. And once that external event happens, these will return to ready. Now, another possibility is that it runs for a while, and the OS stops running it, and it goes back to this ready state, that the program didn't actually, you know, get to a point where it wants something else to happen, but the OS decided, for whatever reason, we'll talk about a bunch of reasons, that it wanted to do something else with the core it was running on, so it's still ready, it's still runnable, but it's not going to be allowed to run, you know, anymore while the OS does something else with the core. Now, eventually we move our threads into this state I label as finished, which XV6 calls zombie. And these are things which are done except for being waited for. So if it was really done, we'd sort of dispose of the thread, but we want to support, in the case of processes, doing wait PID. And that means we need to keep, you know, information about the process around, and you might imagine equivalent for a multi-threaded process, so we can handle this wait PID call and say, okay, is this done yet? So if we call wait PID when it's already done, we can check for something that's in this finished or zombie state and mark it as waited for. If we didn't do this, well, we'd have wouldn't be able to distinguish between weight PID for something that either, you know, never started, you know, or invalid process ID versus something that already finished. And also, we want to be able to eventually reuse process IDs. So, you know, the biggest thing we're trying to avoid is that we don't want to wait PID for some PID that ended up being assigned to some later program. If we're like starting lots of processes, you know, we don't want it to be the case that if I wait PID for 10, I get not the 10 I started, but some 10 that was started, you know, a couple minutes later because it took me a couple minutes to call wait PID. So to do that, we keep around the process in this zombie state or finish state. So questions about these states? So there's a question on related to our earlier thing about multi-threaded processes. Is there a limit to the number of threads? So the answer is the limit to the number of threads the OS can support is how much memory do you have to store information about those threads? Then the second part of this, like many processors, are labeled as 8-core, 16-thread. So this is something that was hoping to kind of avoid, but I guess I need to confront head-on, which is that we're going to be talking about software threads. There's a similar thing that hardware can support, where hardware can have a single physical core that appears to the OS as multiple cores, and these are called hardware threads. And when you see a processor saying it's a 8-core, 16-thread processor, they're referring to those hardware threads. So those will appear as separate cores to the OS. The threads we're talking about are entirely in software and mapped to hardware cores, either real ones or those, you know, virtual cores exposed to the OS by the hardware. So, okay. But that's worth pointing out because, yes, it's confusing that there's both hardware threads and software threads, but we're all going to be talking about software threads here. Other questions? So, question, in the case of having 16 hardware threads, there are 16 virtual threads available. I would say 16 virtual cores available, which are implemented with 8 physical cores. Or I guess probably a more common term than virtual is logical cores. Other questions? This. Okay, so these are sort of our states of our threads, and we want to talk about managing, deciding what threads become ready or runnable, and so on. And a different view we'll have for that, which is handy for thinking about this problem of deciding what to run when, is with queues. So we can say that we have a bunch of queues of threads depending on what state they're in. So we can think of all of our ready or runnable threads are in what we'll call the ready queue. And we're going to take things off this queue, put them on the CPU, and they'll finish. And we'll decide they ran for too long, and they'll go back on the ready queue if they're still runnable. Otherwise, they'll go into that sleeping state where they're waiting for some event, and at least conceptually we'll say we'll have separate queues for each type of event. And in many OSs, these are actual real queues, and our interesting scheduling question is, given each of these queues, what do we take off first? So like, how is this queue gonna be ordered? And that's going to be a question we're going to spend a lot of time thinking about. And we're going to mostly talk about it with respect to this ready queue, but you can ask the same question with, for example, this queue for some I/O device, like a hard drive. We're probably not going to talk about that, but that the same sorts of issues come up, and the high-level approaches are very similar to what we're going to talk about with deciding what to put on the on each core. Now, as I said, this queue representation is a nice way of thinking about things and often how operating systems are written. But I say often because XP6 doesn't have queues. Like, if you look, there's not a list of ready processes. So what does XP6 use to figure out what programs are ready? Well, it just has this array of processes, and it just scans it for entries which are runnable. It scans it to figure out what's waiting for I/O, for entries which are sleeping with the CHAN field set to a particular value. So this is a nice strategy in the sense that we don't have to like do memory allocation to manage variable length list of things. It's not nice in that we're scanning the entire process list to figure out who needs this disk I/O or what process can I run next when there's often only one or two possibilities. So real OSs typically have separate lists for each of these things just to avoid scanning through the entire list of processes, but XP6 doesn't do that, just to keep the code simpler. So as I said, we're going to talk mostly about scheduling, which is deciding what to remove from the queue, and we're going to do it for the ready queue. And we're going to talk about a very, very particular type of scheduling. So we're going to talk about CPU scheduling, so scheduling processor cores. And we're going to talk about it on a system where programs do a lot of I/O. So this means that programs are, using the CPU for a bit, then doing a bunch of I/O, using the CPU for a bit, then doing a bunch of I/O. This is sort of our model of how programs look. And you might reasonably say that's not realistic, but this is a scenario we're going to be looking at primarily, and also where other programs are able to use the CPU when they're doing I/O. So sort of our primary thing we're going to want to take advantage of is while I'm waiting for a key press or a mouse movement, some other program can use the core. And that's a big thing we're going to look at how we take advantage of. And we're also going to only deal with the single CPU case. So this, as I said, seems like a rather specific scenario, but many of the ideas we're going to come up with are going to also work in other scheduling problems, especially some of the simpler ideas we're going to have are also going to be sort of the first things you do even when you have each one of these lines has different constraints. We're going to be mostly concerned under these constraints with choosing a scheduling policy. And what I mean by a scheduling policy is what do we remove given that we have some choices? We're going to think about that. Now, if we're going to talk about these scheduling policies, the decision about what to remove, it's worth looking at how does the XP6 scheduler work? And I'm going to mention that scheduling policy beforehand because you're going to look at the XP6 scheduler and say, oh, there's no policy here. But there is. It's just sort of kind of chosen by accident. So the XP6 scheduler has a rather peculiar structure, which I'm going to go into because we're going to have an assignment that involves modifying it. So the scheduler is actually run in a separate thread. So there's a thread that's just the scheduler, and the scheduler runs this infinite loop where it chooses a thread to switch to and switches to that thread. So a program thread does program stuff until the OS decides it's time to stop, like it ran too long or it needs to do some I/O, and then it switches to the scheduler thread and so on. So sort of if we have like processes A and B, A will run for a bit, we'll do A, and we'll have our scheduler thread. Then we'll switch to our scheduler thread. It will run very briefly, and then, maybe switch to B, which will run for a bit. Then when B's done running, we'll switch. I should use color, it will switch back to the scheduler thread, which will switch to A, So this is sort of how typically things work. So the scheduler thread is just kind of this in-between thing. And we'll talk about why XV6 chose to do this, even though it could have done something where it switches directly from A to B and back, for example. That's not what they did. They just have this scheduler. So here's the scheduler code. I've omitted some parts of it for brevity. So this is started up on each core. So it retrieves a structure for information about the current CPU, and we track the current process which is running on a CPU, and when the scheduler is running, that's set to zero or a null pointer to indicate there's no process running, the scheduler is just looking for something. And the scheduler runs an infinite loop, and during the infinite loop, the first thing it does is this STI function, and this is enable interrupts. And the reason for this is that if there's no process that's running right now, we want to make sure that something like a key press will be handled. This makes that, makes sure that that's going to be the case. Often, XV6 kernel code will run with interrupts disabled, so XV6 can change like data structures related to the keyboard without getting confused. But at this point in time, we want to make sure that if something, you know, just someone just pressed a key and that makes a program runnable, that that exception handler gets to run. After it does that, it acquires a lock on the process table. And part of one side effect of acquiring this lock is that it disables interrupts. So for example, if an exception happens, it won't change the process table while we're examining it. And it won't happen because we just delay exceptions until after we release this process table lock. Or, as we'll see later, after we switch to another program which will re-enable exceptions. And with this lock, it iterates over all the processes and finds the first runnable one. You know, so it just looks for a runnable one. Once it finds one, it switches to it and stores the state to switch back later on to the scheduler from that process. Okay. And that process gets to run for a while, then it switches back to the scheduler, switches back to here, and the scheduler goes to the next iteration of the loop, so it looks at the next process in the list afterwards. And if there's no next process, this loop will finish, and the outer loop will go back to the beginning. And we'll scan from the beginning of the process list again. Questions about the basic structure of this code? So there's a question, is there a special thread that runs the trap function for exceptions? No. So when an exception happens, it occurs in whatever thread is currently active, which could be the scheduler thread or could be one of the process threads. Other questions? Okay, so I've omitted some detail around the switch, so let's look at this process here. So once we've chosen a process to switch to, what do we do? And the scheduler does some bookkeeping. So it records that, I'm running this process. And this is so, like, for example, when you wrote your system calls for XV6 intro, you might have used myproc somewhere or seen, I guess we probably just saw myproc used somewhere. This is, sets up so myproc works. And this switch UVM function sets us up in the address space of the process, so it makes sure that that process is loaded as the into memory, as the currently active thing. So when we, you know, jump to the user code, it's actually loaded, and we mark it as running. And then we switch to it. And after that process runs, we're going to switch. It's going to switch back to here, returning from the switch, and we undo the switch. And you might say, wait a moment, we're not undoing everything. So one thing we do undo is we switch the address space back to an address space without any user stuff. That's what the switch KVM does. So it just unloads the process from memory, so it makes it not active. And we also do some bookkeeping to mark no process is running right now on this core. Now, something you might say is missing is, well, we marked the process as running. How does it get marked as not running? And the answer to that is going to be that before the process switches back to the scheduler, it's going to mark itself as not running. It's going to set its state to something else. Now, another thing that's worth noting here is that in this whole loop, I have this lock over the process table. So I've made sure that I'm the only one accessing the process table. And this might seem like a problem because what if, you know, what does this mean for like another core trying to access the process table? And another thing that's going to happen is after we switch to that process, it's going to release the lock on the process table so other things can use it. And before it switches back to the scheduler, it's going to acquire the lock, which is important because we want to make sure when it changes itself from, you know, running to runnable or to waiting, sleeping, that nothing else looks at the process list and gets confused. That's something that's, whether it's running or not. Okay. This is our actual switch. So I showed switching to a process, and I kind of previewed some things which were happening at the switch back, but let's look at that. So we had our first part here is that the scheduler got this process table locked. It chose, and using that, it looked through the list of processes and, this is not the slide I thought it was. Okay, so we have our scheduler switching. Now, I'm going to talk about the code on the non-scheduler side, right? And we're going to start with the bottom here, so which is that if we're switching to the scheduler, or from this, we're switching from, I have the order wrong. Switching from the scheduler. We'll talk about that first. So the scheduler thread, we showed it switching to a process, and we're going to release the process table lock afterwards, as I mentioned. So I'll show you some code for that. So we mentioned when we start a process in XV6, it starts with the fork ret function. So this is the return from fork function. And that ends up running as a result of being switched to. And one thing that that function does is it releases the process table lock because we know the scheduler switched with exclusive access to the process table. And this ensures that in between the time the scheduler sets a process as running and when it actually switches to it, that nothing gets confused and thinks it's kind and doesn't realize that it's not quite running yet. You can't actually look at the list of processes until it's actually running, not just marked as running. Now let's think about the switching to the scheduler part. So we're going to look at some cases where we end up going, to the scheduler, and mostly this occurs as the result of an exception. And I'm going to talk about sort of the most obvious case, which is that we have the program running for too long, that we have this process here, that it was running and it ran for too long. And in that case, a timer interrupt happens. And the code that handles the timer interrupt and trap calls this function yield. And what the yield function does is it acquires the process table lock. It does that because we're manipulating the list of processes by setting ourselves as a runnable when we were running. Then we call this sched function, which is just a wrapper around a switch to the scheduler for the current core. So this stops our current program from running until the scheduler decides to switch back to us. And when the scheduler switches back, we end up releasing the process table lock because we know the scheduler had had exclusive access to the process table while it was changing what processes were running. Okay. So questions about this code here. So we have this pattern of get exclusive access to the list of processes while we're changing things, then mark ourselves as runnable. So there's a question, why does the P table stay locked during the switch? Couldn't it get stuck there for a while? So I don't think it can really get stuck there for a while because after we switch, we're going to release that lock as soon as either the scheduler finds something else to run. So we're only going to keep exclusive access to the process table for as long as it takes to find something to run, which is typically not very long. So the question is, so the switch quickly returns back from the scheduler. So this sched switches to the scheduler, and the scheduler is running, remember, that loop where it's going to try to find a runnable process. As soon as that happens, as soon as it finds a runnable process, it's going to start running that process and release control of the process table. So there's a question, hey, if when we run a process, it releases the process table lock, why did we have this release here? So when no processes are runnable, what's going to happen is that we're going to run this loop and we're going to find out, oh, first thing's not runnable, second one's not runnable, and so on. And we're going to get to the end of this loop. And if we didn't release the lock, then if some event happened to make a process runnable, it wouldn't be able to change the process table to mark the program as runnable. So we release the lock to make sure that, like, if a key press marks a program as runnable, that it actually can make the change to the list of processes so that happens. Does that answer that question? And then there's a question, do we ever run into a situation where two releases are called? So you mean where we call release after already having released without acquiring first? And the answer is hopefully not, because XV6 has code which detects that and deliberately crashes if you do that. Okay, so I showed you this case for yielding. I mentioned, show you, we switch into the scheduler, and eventually the scheduler will switch back to the same program. We also have similar code for other reasons that a process would stop running. So there's the sleep function, which is used for any case where we go into the waiting state, and it takes an argument, which is, what are we waiting for what? And what it does is it records what we're waiting for, marks the current program as sleeping, and calls the scheduler again. So this does the same thing. We switch to the scheduler loop, but now we're marked as sleeping, so the scheduler won't find us in the iteration until some other code changes the state to runnable. And eventually, after that happens, it will get switched back to. You might say, well, how does this state get changed to runnable? So there's this function wakeup1, which is used, for example, by the key press handler, which just says, okay, look for something that's waiting for, you know, whatever Chan represents. So there's like a value for like a key for like keyboard input. And so just scans for a process waiting for that and marks it as runnable. Okay, so questions about the scheduler transitions? So a question is, where does exactly does sched function go to in the scheduler? The sched function is just contains a switch to current CPU scheduler. So it returns from the scheduler switch function. Other questions, follow-ups? Or I have the argument order wrong here. It returns from the scheduler, so it's switch to that, to C scheduler. Where C is the current core. Anything else? Okay. Don't see anything. Okay, so the XV6 scheduler design makes some weird choices. So we have this separate scheduler thread. And the big advantage of doing this is that it kind of makes the scheduler easier to write. So the scheduler keeps state, and the state, you might say, is last process we ran on the stack of the scheduler thread. If we, you know, didn't keep that p variable around and we wanted to like use the same scheduler design, we kind of have to like write a function which figures out what the, you know, last process was and figures out where in the process list it is and advances and so on. So it makes the scheduler easier to write. The disadvantage is we're calling switch twice as much as we might otherwise need to. And so modern OSs tend not to use this design because of this disadvantage is worth the extra cost of like needing to write your scheduler code in a different way. Also, in another example of sort of a ease of writing code versus performance trade-off, it just scans the process list. In a typical OS that's concerned about performance, it's going to try to just keep a list of runnable threads or waiting threads if we're like waking something up on keyboard input to have better performance. Because if you look at a typical modern, you know, like desktop system, typically there are like hundreds of processes that aren't runnable. And scanning through 100 extra processes all the time would be very slow. And another thing which is atypical is of, you know, real schedulers is that the policy for the scheduler is very intertwined with the code, you know, that manages the scheduling. That the choice of what program to run next is kind of is hard-coded in that scheduler function. So let's start thinking about scheduling policies next. We'll say XV6's scheduling policy is whatever's next in the list. So that's hard-coded, that's a policy. And, you know, when you look at the code, you might say there's no policy there, but there is a policy. The XV6 made the choice, this is what we run next. And we're going to think about, well, what's the best answer? And you might guess, probably not XV6's answer from a, you know, what's the most efficient point of view? Maybe XV6's answer from what's simplest point of view. Before I go on that, any questions about these odd design choices in XV6? Okay. So we're going to think about policies. And I mentioned we're dealing with sort of this very strange scenario of, you know, single CPU scheduling where most programs do IO, we're going to be even more simplifying. We're going to go way back to 1970 and say we're going to have one program per user. So we have like a shared system, one thread per program, and the programs are independent. And you might realize that all of these things are not true, but we're going to use those just to look at some scheduling algorithms, and we'll think about like how this might, you know, expand to when these aren't true. And if you look at this diagram, you can think that programs, like they run on the CPU, then they wait for IO, then they run on the CPU, or they run on the CPU and then wait to use the CPU again, or so on. And we're going to try to model our programs sort of as typically doing something like this loop here. And we're going to say that programs have what I'll call a CPU burst when they use the CPU, and what I might call an IO burst when they wait for IO. And basically what they end up doing is alternating between them, that they're just going in this loop here. Maybe they're occasionally, depending on how the scheduler works, going through this process. And we're going to be concerned about, you know, how long are these CPU bursts and these, how long are these waits for IO? And you might say, is this realistic? And the argument for why it might be realistic is if we think of like a shell. A shell waits for a key press, then quickly does something in response to that key press. Or like a drawing program, it waits for a mouse press or so on, then quickly does something in response to that, then waits for the next one. A web browser waits for your key presses and mouse presses, like that drawing program, and also waits for like a remote web server and then quickly does something to, as quick as it can, to show something on the screen. So this is going to be our model of programs. And there's so a lot of programs that fit well into this model, some which don't fit so well into this model. Like if you think of like computing something that takes a long time, doesn't really fit into this model very well. But this is our model, is that we're going to have these CPU bursts alternating with IO bursts, and sort of our program runs this loop of doing that. And if we have this model of programs, an important question for dividing schedulers is how long are these CPU bursts? And we can kind of measure this empirically. So I have some measurements here from a while ago that show the compute time from a command being entered to the next command prompt. And this is in ticks, so this is, one is 16.7 milliseconds, two is 32 milliseconds, and so on. And remember, this is with a somewhat slower computer than what we might be used to today. And we can see that on this system, the time of what might be kind of an approximation of CPU bursts typically is like 32 milliseconds, and sometimes is on the couple seconds range. So the units of CPU bursts we want to run, the amount of time that should happen, is not actually that long, even on this very old system. And we also have this pattern that's going to be very common, where most of our CPU bursts are very short, but we have some which are much, much, much longer. And you might say, this data is slightly old. Do I have something newer? Yes, but you might still be disappointed. It's hard to find people who've measured this in a kind of realistic system. But here's something from many years after that, and it shows a similar pattern. Note that like this is a small number of microseconds to a couple milliseconds to seconds, and we have the same pattern where sort of our typical range is a few microseconds, and you know, we have some significant amount of time where you know it's not most of the time, but a lot of our time is going to be spent on these longer bursts. But most of the time a program wants to use the processor, you know, it's for these very short periods of time in between IO operations. Okay, so our typical typical program pattern is that we have the short millisecond long CPU burst followed by milliseconds, maybe more of IO. And there's some exceptions where, you know, we might be in this scenario where we want the CPU forever. They're important, but that's not our typical case, not most of what our scheduler is dealing with. And this makes sense when we think of interactive applications. It also makes sense for things that are like reading or writing from a disk. The disk might be slower than the processing it's doing on the data. Same thing might be true for the network. So this occurs naturally in a lot of programs, especially interactive ones, but also some non-interactive ones that have to get their data from a disk or the network. And in this model, a ready queue we can think of as a list of CPU bursts to run. So we're going to think of our scheduling problem as we have a bunch of CPU bursts that are ready to run, and our question is, what do we want to run out of the options? So we're going to have a list in our ready queue of CPU bursts, and we're going to say, you know, given those, what do we want to run, you know, in what order? Now, something this doesn't account for is that in practice, we're going to have like, you know, we have like A and B want to run are in our ready queue, and maybe C is waiting for IO. And what's going to happen is, let's say we decide to run B first. Well, while B is running, you know, B is on the CPU, C might become runnable. And there's a question of what do we do about that? We're going to account for that, you know, that sort of issue later. And there's also a question of, like, after B runs, you know, it might become runnable again. We're going to look at that later. We're just going to first start with the simpler scenario of, I'm going to ignore this C and just say we have A and B waiting to run. How do we run them? And the big thing we want to think about is, how do we measure how good we are at running things? And we need some metrics to decide, you know, when we've made this choice about whether we run A then B or B then A or A alternating with B, you know, of the things in our ready queue, like, what's best? And I have three different metrics we're going to think about. So one is I'm going to call turnaround time. You might also see something similar referred to as response time. I'm going to use the term turnaround time because response time sometimes means something different. And this is the time from when the program becomes runnable, from submission, so runnable, until finished. So this is runnable to done. Done the CPU burst. We also might be concerned about throughput. Throughput is just how much work do we get done overall? You might say, well, you know, if we have two things to run, why does it matter? Well, the big issue is what I'll call overhead, you know, time spent doing not useful work. And a classic example of that is time spent context switching. So let's say we have A and B are runnable. And let's say the way I decide to run them is I run A for 1 millisecond, then B for 1 millisecond, then A for 1 millisecond, then B for 1 millisecond. If I compare this to like running A for a while and B for a while, this switching quickly is going to be slower because that switching isn't free. It takes some time. And another thing you might be concerned about is fairness. So remember I talked about our idea of thinking about like one program per user. So if we're thinking about it that way, we want to treat each user the same. And fairness is this idea that, you know, both users should get the same kind of performance, that we shouldn't massively favor one user over the other, you know, whether on purpose or by accident. So, kind of look at some of these. So when we're dealing with CPU bursts, our turnaround time is going to be the time to start the next I/O. So if I have a program which where I have like a key press to make for program A, so let's say A here is A, and this is my time. And let's say A runs on the CPU here and here. Then the turnaround time is the time from which we could have started running A until when we actually finished running A, and A was waiting for I/O again. Oh, versus here, A would be runnable. But presumably we decided to run something else instead. And this here is our turnaround time. Mentioned throughput. So with throughput, our primary concern is the useful work done per unit time. So if our context switch takes time, we'd say in this case, you know, we have that wasted time means we don't have 100% throughput. We have some lower number, even though we've done all the work we have. And with fairness, you know, we're thinking intuitively, we want to treat each program the same. So you might, you know, there's easy cases like, well, the second timeline seems fairer. But it actually gets tricky when we talk about sort of formalizing this. You know, for example, like you might ask, there's, if we just swap A and B in this timeline, it becomes a lot trickier to say which is fairer. You know, or like if we swap them in this timeline, but the timeline ends here, which is fairer. So the details are tricky, but intuitively we know, you know, yeah, we want to treat them equally. You know, this first one here timeline doesn't do that. Okay, so we've talked about metrics, and let's do a little quiz here. So I have three different timelines for what programs want to do. So program A, it has a CPU burst, then it does some I/O, then it has a second CPU burst. So it has two CPU bursts. And program B and C have one CPU burst, and initially they're all ready. And we have three different schedules here. And I'm asking which is best for throughput, mean turnaround time, so the average turnaround time for each CPU burst the programs have. We have four of them. And which is best for sort of responsiveness. Like, which would you, if you wanted to like use this system and interact with it, which would you think would be most useful? So question, well, thinking about this, would it be fair if each process get equals resources, but it's more fair if they get allocated on need? Yeah, so one of the issues with comparing the fairness of schedules is, what do you do about a process which needs less resources? Another part of it is that we're not just talking about whether you get the same amount of CPU, but also how quickly you get the CPU. So like if we give one program less CPU but run it more quickly, and give another program more CPU but run it less quickly, is that fair? If we change how much we do that, which way is more fair? Like those definition ideas get, you know, very tricky, and it depends exactly on how you define fairness. Okay, I'm going to, well, since I want time to talk about this, I'm going to close this a little earlier than I would otherwise. So, for best for throughput, most people say one, and I agree because we have the fewest context switches, so probably we're spending the most time, so we're spending most time running programs. For, and I'll talk about sort of Oh, I didn't actually ask mean turnaround time, but for mean turnaround time, if we think about this, the turnaround times here are, this is one turnaround time, our mean turnaround time is probably best in one, because in two, we have a high turnaround time for B, and in three, we have a really high turnaround time for B, and also in two, we have a high turnaround time for A's first CPU burst, even though we have a short one for A's second, and, in three, we have the high turnaround time for D and the same turnaround time for A's first CPU burst, and also a very high turnaround time for C. Questions about these answers? And for fairness, most people said three. Three is a reasonable answer. I think you could also make a case for two or for one. So I think I'm out of time here. So I'll take any questions before I sign off, but I see you next week. Can you ask about the quiz? Yes.
Hi, Professor. On one of the quiz answers, I wrote none with a capital N instead of a lowercase n.
So we should deal with issues like that in grading, which will happen over about a week from when the quiz was released. I have a TA who goes through all the answers. If next week that isn't done, either email me or submit a regrade on the submission site. But it should be handled. Yes, we don't intend to be like sensitive to, those sorts of mistakes.
Thank you.
Okay. Question, did I answer which is best for responsiveness? Generally, what's best for mean turnaround time is best for responsiveness. So one is better for responsiveness. If we think about two, we're spending all this time, A is taking a while to actually respond to whatever event it's waiting for here, and also B and three is taking a long time to respond to whatever it's waiting for. Whatever's waiting for it, I should say.
Okay.